everybody. Good morning, good morning. It's great to be with you. I'm over here not because I like this side of the room more. I just feel like we got a little tight with the keyboard. So I'll try to come over and give you guys some love too. Not that if you've ever been up on the stage, I can see many of you. So feel free to do whatever you need to right now. Pull out your phone, talk to your neighbor. But I'm so excited to dive in this morning to a conversation around Encounter. So I wanted to begin with the most riveting of all interests of mine, which are sociological studies. Anyone else really love a good sociological study? I want to show you a classic that's going to come up on the screen here. So it was written in the year 2000. So go back in your mind to wherever you were in the year 2000. You can see the graphic design is really top notch. But if we go back here to Bowling Alone, this is a study by a man named Robert Putnam, who had an observation. It's kind of an interesting observation that from the year 1980 until the year 2000, so over a 20-year window, the number of Americans who were bowling went up, so more and more people were bowling, but the number of people participating in bowling leagues went down, right? This is a pretty simple observation. I've got you riveted right now. We're talking about bowling, sociological studies. You are with me. Here's why this mattered for Robert Putnam. As he looked at this trend over 20 years, he started to ask, why is it in America that there are more opportunities, more space, more time, more money for the growing middle class? Why is it that all of this is increasing and we're seeing things like more people are bowling, more people are entertaining themselves, more people are enjoying these kinds of extracurriculars, and yet there is less community taking place across the United States? He does this huge survey, looks at a ton of different factors. He asks questions like, is the reason that there's less community that people are no longer living in cities as much? And he's like, no, that's really not maybe it. Is the reason that people aren't in community because they're not participating in church life or political parties or social clubs like the Rotary Club or whatever else was going on in communities? No, he says, that's probably not it. The main conclusion that Putnam comes to is that from the year 1950 to the year 2000, one of the hugest shifts that took place was the advent of the television, which allowed people to be entertained by themselves rather than having to seek out entertainment in community. And so some of this influence seeped into the ethos of what it means to be American. And so now, suddenly, we have found ourselves taking this pleasurable extracurricular activity, bowling, which surely is more fun doing with other people, and yet for some reason Americans are now more and more choosing to do it alone. Okay, that was a little bit of a time capsule because the study was released in the year 2000, and at the end of the study, Putnam sort of ominously puts forth this idea, this vision, that he says, you know, as I look ahead, I'm concerned that our technology is going to get better, which means that our entertainment is going to get more immersive, but also more isolating. And we're going to struggle more and more to find meaningful ways to connect with other people. Well, I have a few stats if you haven't glanced at it already. One of the reoccurring themes that I'm sure you've heard, this is not new information, is that over the last 20 years in particular, mental health on all measurable scales has significantly declined for Americans. So this is somewhat counterintuitive, right? We have more money, we have more entertainment, we have more opportunities. Why is our mental health plummeting? You see here that blue line for children is the child wellness index. So all the signs that children should be having more access to food, more access to education, more access to play, all of that's going up, but mental health in children, depressive symptoms are going down. Let's go to the next slide. This is the percentage of the population with a major depressive episode in the past year by age 2008 to 2020. Do you notice that, like, it's just an upward trajectory, right? This is getting worse and worse and worse. Let's go to the next one. This is the most interesting. People talk about this one quite a bit. When you look at the suicide rate per 100,000 people, there is a marked and noticeable uptick that has not abated since any observation what year it was that graph starts to turn. If you can see it, some of you are far away. I'm realizing the numbers are quite small. That middle shift here is the year 2008. Anyone know the year that the iPhone was invented? 2008. Facebook began in 2006, right? So there's this growing sense, and again, I'm not saying anything new. You can look up all kinds of books and resources on this. There is a growing consensus that the advent of technology, in particular social media, has started to devastate a generation where this initial impulse to bowl alone has only grown worse and worse and worse because we have more and more opportunities to find and to taste this sort of false entertainment, right? It's like our phones are offering us the allure of more, and yet the more time any of us spend on our phones, the growing sense of emptiness only increases. Here's the last stat, last graph for you. Four is my limit. I will never push you past four graphs. This one's pretty clear, right? This is the year 2019. So this was in the middle of COVID, and this number has declined a little bit, but I just like to think about this stat for just a minute. 79% of Gen Z report significant periods of loneliness that regularly occur week to week. 79%. And you're probably, if you are Gen Z sitting here, you're like, yeah, right? Like, we're supposed to feel that way, right? Like, society's supposed to be lonely. Isn't that like what everybody feels? Like, this is what we're supposed to feel. I mean, the overall percentage is 61% of Americans who report feeling lonely. 61% of Americans. This has led to a slew of books. I'll give you one last slide here. Analyzing this problem, within a four-year period, so the first one there by Johan Hari, Lost Connections, came out in 2018. Then The Crisis of Connection came out in 2020, right after COVID. Most recently, in the last year, this one's been pretty big in my circles, The Lonely Century, How to Restore Human Connection in a World That's Pulling Apart. Here's why I'm going through all this. I just want to take you into our cultural moment, and I want to draw your attention to the fact that a significant shift has occurred. But I wanted to give you just a little bit more than sort of this doomsday or like phones are all bad or social media is the worst or millennials and Gen Z are totally screwed, even though we might be, right? And what I want to give you instead is a bit of a diagnosis as we move towards this encounter with Jesus. I promise I'm going to take you into this text and invite the question, what difference does Jesus make to this moment we find ourselves in? But here's the dilemma. Because our technology is shifting, because our culture is stuck, we find ourselves isolated and alone, and instead of being able to connect with others, we are turning to our phones. And the more we do that, the worse we become, the more isolated we become, the more paranoid we become. They've done studies on political parties that say you're actually, the more lonely you feel, you're more likely to get involved in politics, to form political opinions, which I think all of us feel and see across all social media platforms, right? And so we now find ourselves in 2024, in an election year, hotly contested, heated divisions, ideologies that are pushing us further and further apart, and the need, the longing that none of us can seem to get our heads around is that if we just stop bowling alone and start bowling together, then maybe we could restore these connections that have been lost. Okay, if that is where we need to go, who can help us get there? Where is a vision or a picture for what connection can look like? I want to take you into the Gospel of Mark. We are doing this series, just so you know, from now until Easter, that is on the Gospel of Mark. So last week, we were in Mark 1. This week, we're now in Mark 5. We're going to keep looking at these different scenes that Mark gives us about who Jesus is. And these ultimately are scenes of encounter, a scene where Jesus finds us. This is really the invitation of these passages. Finds us in our lives, in our world, in our crises, and offers us some good news about who Jesus is. Now, the last intro or warning I want to give you, as Lee already alluded to, is that this is a rather fun passage. I would love to hear from any of you afterwards if you've ever heard a sermon or a teaching on this passage before. I'll go ahead and put Mark 5 up on the screen. And what you'll immediately notice is that this is the passage on the man who is possessed by demons. So I just want you to know we are going to talk about it, okay? So if you're already feeling like, what are we talking about? We're going to talk about it this morning. I hope to bring some clarity to this, but I'm excited to dive in. So let's go ahead and look at Mark 5. If you have a Bible on your phone, you can feel free to open it. We'll have it up here on the screen as well. I just want to take you into the scene. Remember, this is a scene of encounter. So this is Mark 5, 1 to 5. They went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an impure spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. Okay, so let's talk about this scene. Because the main thing to note, if you were in the ancient world, that would stand out to you, is that the passage wants to get our attention, that as Jesus shows up in this region, actually this region of the Gerasenes, notably is not in Israel. So Jesus has already left Israel, where the Jewish people were living, and he is now in a Gentile region. So already Jewish people kind of looked down on participating in Gentile regions. There's just a lot of dangerous stuff going on over there. We're going to see in just a moment that there are pigs here in this region, which for a Jewish person would not have been kosher, quite literally. It would not have been clean. And so you kind of were in dangerous territory whenever you'd find yourself among the impure Gentiles. So this is where Jesus intentionally goes. But in this impure region, Jesus encounters a man who we're told has an impure spirit. An impure spirit is in him. Now, we're going to have to explore what this impure spirit is. In fact, Jesus is going to have to explore what this impure spirit is. But there's one last catch that is pretty easy for us to miss. We're told that this man comes from the tombs to meet Jesus. And then we're also told that night and day among the tombs and in the hills, this man lived. For a Jewish person, there was sort of these gradients of purity, of how you could cleanse yourself to be prepared to enter into God's presence. And then there were all these factors that could make you impure, which meant you were no longer in a position to enter into worship, to enter into God's presence. And one of the worst things you can do for impurity is to touch a dead body or to be near a dead body. And so if a Jewish person walked into a tomb or touched someone who had been in a tomb, they would be impure, right? So the point that Mark is sort of drawing our attention to is we're in an impure region, we've got an impure spirit, we've got this man coming from an impure place amongst the tombs, right? So everything about this says Jesus should have nothing to do with this man. That's the first interesting thing, that this man is impure. But when we read this description of what's going on in this man, what we start to see this picture is that whatever this impure spirit is within this man has thoroughly isolated him. And yet, if you can just slow down with the description, it's a little confusing. Did this man isolate himself from the community, or did the community force this man to be isolated? You catch that? Like, people from the community are trying to bind this man because they are terrified by him. And in trying to bind him, he then would have such violent strength that he would break the bonds they were trying to use to contain him. And as he would do this, night and day, I mean, the result, like, you almost see this contest going forth. The community would say, somebody's got to go out to take care of him. Like, can we try this again? They'd bring chains. They'd go to bind him. This man would do something terrifying. I'm sure everybody would flee, take off. And then this man left with all of this consequence and violence is then howling day and night among the tombs and cutting himself, literally showing a sign of the violence within forcing itself to be expressed in his body. I think the reason why I'm trying to slow down with this is before we jump into all of the spiritual conversation about demonic activity or demon possession or spiritual warfare, all of which are great conversations to have, I just want you to first be able to see here is a lonely, terrified, isolated man who has been cast out from society that nobody wants, that nobody needs, nobody is attending to. And every religious sign of the day says that a religious figure, a religious leader like Jesus should have nothing to do with this man. And somehow, Jesus has intentionally entered in and drawn near to have an encounter with this man. Now, I don't know about you, but as much as our society likes to think, oh, that impure, clean distinction in Jewish thought, I mean, that's quite archaic, right? We would never do that. Like, we would never say, like, wash your hands before you come in to the theater. Oh, okay, maybe during COVID, we were a little concerned about clean and unclean, right? So maybe we were doing a little bit of extra hand sanitizer before we'd shake hands. But even more than that, I think in our society, to just gently press on us, like, as you think about your social status, as you think about the clothing you wear, the cars that you drive, the phone that you have, whether it's an Android or an iPhone, right? Like, this can be kind of humorous, but we do as a society, we move in this world of, like, pure and impure, clean and unclean. We kind of have this natural tendency in our social status and interactions. This especially took place back in high school, right? This was like the extreme and the obvious that if you showed up with a new backpack, that was the right backpack. I don't know what the right one was for you. It was like maybe JanSport for me back. I wasn't very cool. I didn't really get very far in the social status sphere. But if you show up with it in high school, then it's kind of like you've got your extra swagger, you've got your respect. But if you show up with the wrong one, or the wrong shirt, or the wrong color, or the wrong words, right? You'd feel the disdain, the contempt, maybe even the words, the cruel cutting words of high school. We've all grown up since then, but you know as well as I do that we still live in this tension between connectivity, this longing to belong, like the society, the community, your office workplace accepts you, loves you, embraces you, admires you, and the feeling, the fear, the desperate attempt to escape that experience of rejection that results in isolation, that can then compound and feel worse and worse and worse until you start getting to that point where you're like, does anybody at my work even care if I exist? Does anybody in my building care if I exist? Like, why do I just feel so lonely all the time? I think this is why this story matters for us today. Because now let me address the spiritual reality taking place in this story. In the Bible, to just invite you in, the Bible puts very clearly forward that there is a material realm, the world that we inhabit, the world that you and I can see, and this physical realm is governed by certain laws and all seems to work in an order with nature and flow in the way that it's supposed to flow. But then the Bible, provocatively to us as 21st century urban dwellers, suggests there is equally an unseen spiritual realm that is operating, that is surrounding, that is influencing the physical material realm which we can know and see. Now, this is the part that if you're paying attention drives you a little bit crazy, because you should naturally want to ask, how do we know what's going on in a realm we can't see? And here, unfortunately, is what the Bible says. You can't. You can't know exactly what's taking place here in the spiritual realm. You have to do your best working off of the physical, material realm that you're paying attention to try to observe the signs and influences of what's taking place in the spiritual realm. Now, that is quite scary, actually, if you think about it seriously, right? That there is a spiritual realm that you can't see and that you can't control. The good news is that as the Bible leaves us a little bit stranded, a little bit like, okay, well, what are we supposed to do? Over and over and over again, the Gospels present Jesus as the one who walks onto the scene and has complete authority over the physical, material realm that he created, which is quite a bold claim that Christianity makes, and complete authority over the spiritual realm, which he sees, understands, and also creates and controls. So in Mark 4, we're told that Jesus is on a boat with his disciples, and all of a sudden a storm takes place. And Jesus is lying down in the back of the boat. He apparently is fast asleep, and the disciples are freaking out because the physical world, the material world, has gotten out of control. They are a little bit terrified. And so they go ahead and wake Jesus up, and they're like, are you not afraid? Like, what's taking place here? This is overwhelming. And Jesus stands and he looks at the waters and he says, peace, be still. We're told the seas calmed. This is because Jesus, the Son of God, is Lord and King over the physical, material world. This is what Mark's trying to tell us. Now, in the very next chapter, we find this man with an impure spirit, and this lets us dive back into the story to understand a little bit more of what's going on. This man shows up to Jesus. So now Jesus has just had this sort of like confrontation with the material realm that seems quite chaotic and uncontainable and out of control. And Jesus has just caused peace to come through his authority, through his lordship over it. Now Jesus is going to have an interaction with a spiritual realm encounter in which something very wild and chaotic and terrifying is happening for any of us who would enter into the scene. And let's just see what Jesus does. This is now Mark 5, 6 to 8. When he, the demon-possessed man, saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? In God's name, don't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you impure spirit." Now, there's actually a little bit, if you can like embrace some levity here to the story, there's a little bit of irony that like this happens over and over and over again with the spiritual realm. There are these impure spirits, these forces that seem to be influencing and shaping the world from the position of evil, and yet they always recognize Jesus as the authority that they fear, and even ironically are saying, "In God's name, don't torture me." I mean, it's kind of ironic, right? Like, you just acknowledged he was God, and yet you're like, I'm calling upon God, you, to like honor God by not torturing me. This demon is a little bit confused and senses that Jesus is about to do something disruptive to the pressures and forces that are taking place from this impure spirit. Now, this is where the story gets really interesting. This is Mark 5, 9 to 10. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And the response comes, "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." I get chills every time I read that part. It feels very cinematic to me. And I think the point is, it feels very scary, right? Like, this is now an encounter where we're beginning to see, Mark is kind of dramatically unveiled, there are actually many spirits within this man. In fact, legion, in a Roman legion, would have 6,000 soldiers. So there's this implication, one, that there could be thousands upon thousands of these compounded impure spirits. And two, by saying legion, the demon is drawing forth this militaristic image to suggest conflict could be happening. Like, if you're here for a fight, we are legion. But he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. Let me just do one last pause here, because I realize this is a complex passage. Some of what has helped me in the 21st century try to figure this out for you who also lives in the 21st century, as we try to like figure out what any of this means, like physical realm, spiritual realm. Didn't expect this at church this morning. Why are we talking about demons? I never wanted to do that. Or maybe like, why don't we always talk about demons? This is all I'm interested in now. Please tell me more. I've heard some really helpful analysis. I think a lot of Christians have explored that in the last 100 years, there's been the advent of psychology as a field of study. And if you sit in psychology, Freud did not believe in God, only wanted to focus on the material realm, but ironically suggested, you know, every person has a subconscious and an unconscious that they cannot see, and that subconscious and unconscious is influencing everything that all people are doing all the time. It sounds a bit, if I might be a little tongue-in-cheek, like a spiritual realm to me, right? Like, it sounds a little bit like Freud was trying to talk about spirituality without talking about spirituality. And so some Christian thinkers have put forth, you know, when we get into the complexities of mental health, when we get into the complexities of diagnoses and some of these more extreme states of human condition, whether it's bipolar or schizophrenia or dissociative conditions, I mean, there's all kinds of crazy stuff in the DSM-5. What's interesting is that we're seeing the symptoms express themselves. We can diagnose them psychologically, but the best psychologists, you can read the literature with me, tell me if you find something better. All the psychologists I read say, we don't really know exactly what causes some of these more extreme conditions. Like, there seems to be some genetics, and there's definitely some circumstance, but it's almost like there's this unseen realm where forces or pressures are taking place, and things then are happening and shifting within a person. And we try to treat it medically, and let me just be really clear. Medication is super helpful. I've been close, especially to a couple people who I love, who have suffered from bipolar, who have sought different medications, and it really, really helps. Medication is incredible. Let's use the physical realm to address physical conditions as we see them. But, I think if we can just sit with this for a moment, it's not impossible to see that there's this overlap between a man whom today we would diagnose as a schizophrenic, who's hearing voices, who seems to be having wild manic episodes, and certainly is self-injuring, with in Jesus' day, none of that language, none of that terminology, but with a sense of there are forces and pressures that have an evil origin at work that need to be confronted by a greater spiritual authority. So in Mark 5, 14 to 15, in Mark 5, 13, we're told that Jesus gave them permission and the impure spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. 2,000 pigs. Can you sit with that for me again? I think what's funny about this passage is that it's quite serious, but then it's also quite humorous all at the same time. 2,000 pigs. Have you ever seen 2,000 pigs? I have never seen 2,000 pigs. I have no idea the terror of 2,000 pigs simultaneously charging and then heading into water and drowning themselves. It's funny, but then it's also terrible, right? And ironically, some of it, as I was working through this passage, some of what comes up is that recently there's been a lot of PETA influence that says, this is horrible. Why didn't Jesus save the pigs, right? Do animals matter? Yes, they do. Jesus loves animals. What about the little piggies? Did the little piggies not need to be saved by Jesus? And here's my response to that. I think even that impulse misses the point of this verse, that if this is what happened to 2,000 pigs, can you imagine what was taking place inside the life of this man who was being tortured relentlessly? Did not his life matter more as the top priority to Jesus? Did not his freedom? So now this is where we could end the passage here and I could try to help land to so spiritual realm and mental health, isolation and community. I'm going to come back to all of this and see if we can engage in a genuine prayerful encounter with Jesus. But there's one last layer to this. And this is where I just love this passage because it feels so real life and complex to me. Here's Mark 5, 14 to 15. Those tending the pigs, right? We didn't know they were there, but clearly if there's 2,000 pigs, there were people watching who were nearby who suddenly saw these pigs just take off together simultaneously down to the water. They run off and report in the town and countryside to tell them something crazy has happened. So the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there dressed and in his right mind. And they were afraid, right? So the whole village has now gathered because this is truly a huge event. And in fact, these 2,000 pigs were probably owned by the wealthiest landowner or one of the wealthiest landowners of the village. This would have been an economic catastrophe in the village, truly. In our day, these are thousands and thousands of Teslas being driven into a lake, right? These are valuable property that has just been destroyed so that this man could be freed. And here we find this contrasting picture of the economic cost to help someone recover from possession, with the result that because of this cost, this man is now freed. But who has to bear this cost? Sit with this with me for just a moment. This is now Mark 5, 16 to 17. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. I just love that Mark catches this. Mark's like, everybody's amazed that this demon-possessed man is now here, but you can't help but notice they're also very fixated on the pigs that were lost. Then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. I think this is our contemporary struggle. We find ourselves caught in this moment where here is a man who is impure, who is unclean, who is pressed away and cast out of society, but who now has had the hope of freedom and restoration because of an encounter with the living God. And over here is the community as it is, trying to get its head around a realm it can't see, that's only fixation is on what it's going to cost them to be in relationship to this man, right? And here, the reason why I started with that strange 2000 study, Bowling Alone, is I just, all week, I keep coming back to this idea that it's like, we want freedom, right? We want connection. We want the living God. Like, if I were to tell you all the things Jesus promises to offer to you, not a single person here, not a single person in all of Chicago would say, I'm not really interested in that kind of forgiveness, that kind of love, that kind of connection to the living God, that kind of connection to a community of friends that gets together on a regular basis. In fact, let me just really quick tell a story that my wife recently was in London, and she was on a work trip, and she was with her supervisor, and they were sitting at the table, and we recently had the privilege of being hosted at a meal by a couple in our church, which if you're around with us for a long time, like, meals are happening in this community all the time, so this wasn't a big deal. But she's just talking about this couple, and the supervisor asks, where are they from? How do you know them? And my wife says, well, they're part of our church. She says, you just, like, get meals with people in your church. Like, did you know them before? No, we met them through the church. Like, that's how we met them. They invited us over to their house, and so then, like, we went for a meal, and it was great. And she said, I don't remember the last time I ever went to someone's home like that for a meal, honestly. Like, my husband and I just don't do that now. That's not what we do in the city. This is the moment of Bowling Alone. This is the, like, we are longing for connection. We are longing for community. And yet when we hear the correlated cost to follow Jesus, the cost that it might have for you, the things you might have to give up, the behaviors, the thoughts, the submission that you might be required to extend to a Lord and Savior outside of your control. I mean, we find ourselves like, could I bowl? Could I just do it by myself? Could I get connection? But could I just find connection alone? In this moment, here's the last scene from the story. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Jesus did not let him go, but said, go home to your own people and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much God had done for him, and all the people were amazed. You catch the contrast? Town pleading with Jesus to leave, and Jesus does. With the man begging Jesus to let him go with him, and Jesus saying, no, you need to stay. You need to stay because it actually is the community that has rejected you that most needs to hear the good news of what you've found in me, right? So here's what we want for you this morning. I realize there's a lot in this passage. I realize I've given you a lot to chew on. I want to be clear. I'm not trying to land the plane, so to speak, when it comes to all of this conversation around spirituality and what it means, or any fears or dangers you have around demons or the demonic. If you want to talk about that, please come up and talk to me afterwards. What I am trying to say is that there is a spiritual realm we cannot see or control, that is at work. This is at least what the Bible tells us is true. And in these encounters, what we need more than anything else is the one who has authority and power over both our material and our spiritual realm. And so our goal this morning with such a heavy passage is to acknowledge that there's probably some of us here who are going through a lot of different things. There's probably some of us here that when I put that slide up on the screen about loneliness, you looked around at your neighbors and said, oh, you mean there's some people who aren't lonely, right? There's probably some of you here who are in the middle, as I have been in the middle of working through various mental health struggles, and who maybe in this moment just need some hope, some love, some freedom that could come from sitting with Jesus. Or maybe for you, there just even is somebody that's come to mind, somebody who isn't here in this space, but somebody who actually is on the outskirts of town, right? Maybe this is a certain people in the city. Maybe this is a specific friend. Maybe this is a coworker, a family member. Maybe it's that person you pass by on the street every day that you look at. And as we sit in this moment, I just want to ponder with you what it would mean for them to have an encounter with Jesus. So last week, we invited you to just get comfortable in your chair, and we're going to spend just a moment in prayer. It's going to be a gentle pad. If you're not comfortable, that's totally fine. Keep your eyes open. Check out what's going on in the room. We're not trying to do anything weird. But if you are comfortable, we wanted to just move from text to encounter and give a little bit of space to see if Jesus has anything to share with you, to say to you this morning. So I like to put my hands on my knees. I tend to like, after a lot of information, like you've just heard, to take a deep breath in, even hold it for a second, and then breathe out through your mouth. Normally, you can go ahead and do it one more time. Just a deep breath in, hold it for a second, and then breathe out through your mouth. We enter into a prayer. I just want to invite you to activate your imagination. If you've never done this before, this is really all it feels like. Just allow your mind to picture a scene. And following the story this morning, I want to invite you to picture a scene or a moment where you felt particularly isolated or alone. Maybe this was a moment, season in your life. Maybe this was a particularly painful or embarrassing memory. Maybe it's just even like a vague sense of a place, an apartment, a home. Could be your childhood home, could be your office today. As you're picturing this lonely place, I want to invite you to invite Jesus to appear here. What would that mean or look like? How would you respond to Jesus entering into the space with you? Is there stress? Is there fear? Is there shame? Jesus is here in this space with you. How does Jesus respond to you? Is it an arm on your shoulder? Are there words already that Jesus wants to say or to speak? As you take just a moment in this place to keep listening to Jesus, my prayer is that he would explore this place with you just a bit. In the same way he explored with this man, what is your name? What is the name of this place? Why does this place hurt as much as it does? Here's my boldest prayer for you. Jesus is in this place with you. Jesus wants to remind you that he has all power and authority over the world that is seen and the world that is unseen. For me, I just pictured Jesus placing his hand on my head. And Jesus says, I want you to be free. Is there anything as Jesus stands with you in this place that he wants to send away? Is there anything that Jesus wants to free you from? Even this morning, thought, a wound, an addiction, a behavior. As we go ahead and close this time of prayer,